Max was babysitting the Nazi officer who was loyal to Zimmer. The dead man, his neck was snapped, covered over by a tarp in the bottom of the launch, and the two Russian sailors cuffed and sedated aboard the flying boat under the eyes of the pilot and co-pilot. Max, it appeared, didn't do things by half. The launch moved away from the flying boat, Rourke at its controls. With Kronberg to bellow orders as the launch came alongside, and the Nazi officer who was loyal to Zimmer under threat of death from Max, there was a chance they could get aboard the Russian trading pirate ship without incident. Getting from the launch to the main deck would be the only truly dicey part. The seas were only moderate, and aside from the occasional swell, the ride to the trader was smooth.
I will board first, and this fellow will follow me with Max behind him. I suggest that you should be last.
How well is Max armed?
Is always well armed. That is why he is Max.
Rourke nodded. About a half dozen personnel were on the main deck of the trader, peering over the side as Rourke brought the launch alongside the ladder. There was a helicopter landed on the aft section of the main deck, apparently the means by which the Nazi personnel had come to the vessel and the means by which Kronberg was to be returned to the mainland. There would be a pilot for the aircraft, a loose end needing relatively immediate attention before the fellow could get airborne or get on the radio. John Rourke brought the launch to rest along a crudely made float dock. Max tied off, stepping out onto the dock and grabbing hold of the ladder, ostensibly helping the Nazi officer with him to get onto the dock. But Rourke was watching the way Max gripped the man's arm. Had the man moved, Max could have thrown him into the water instantly and probably broken his arm at the same time. Kronberg stepped out onto the dock, immediately starting up the ladder. Rourke climbed out, exchanged a glance with Max, then shifted the weight of the two special Musette bags he carried with him, each loaded with disposable syringes, each of these in turn containing enough sedative to put a man out for several hours. Max let the Nazi officer start toward the ladder.
Remember, you would die first.
The Nazi took to the ladder, Max following him just far enough below that it would be impossible for the Nazi officer to kick him in the face. Rourke glanced back at the flying boat, then toward the main deck above, then started climbing. As Rourke reached the rail, looking over, he saw Kronberg, Max, and the Nazi officer all in conversation with the apparent captain and first mate of the trader. When Rourke stepped aboard, all eyes turned toward him. If Kronberg had betrayed him, Rourke would bring Kronberg down with him.
Here, this is the man who assisted me in discovering the plot.
This was not in the script. Rourke said nothing.
It was he. As you can see, he is the clone of John Rourke, who was kidnapped from Dr. Zimmer's facility in the Himalayas. But, unbeknownst to the enemies of the Reich, this clone, a physically identical duplicate of Dr. John Thomas Rourke, the notorious terrorist and enemy of the Reich, carries within him the identical memories of Dr. Dietrich Zimmer. They think as one. So, in a sense, you are, Captain Turgenev, you and your men, in the presence of the Führer. Heil Zimmer!
John Rourke smiled.
Where the hell did you get that crazy idea?
Rourke and Kronberg moved along a narrow companionway toward the radio room, Max still keeping the Nazi officer beside him.
And I detected that more than 2 dozen Russian sailors were on the main deck and heavily armed, Doctor.
And they bought it!
That's miraculous.
They are simple men, and news of what transpired at the secret base in the Himalayas was widely broadcast. I merely informed them of what a clone was.
They were nearing the radio room. The captain of the trader was the first to enter, followed by Rourke and Kronberg, then Max and the Nazi officer after. Rourke had little faith in Kronberg's charade holding up for much longer. As soon as they were all in the radio room and the door was closed, Rourke stepped back and drew the scoremasters from under his jacket.
Gentlemen, hands up.
Why do we do this?
Safer this way. Tell Max to find the pilot of the helicopter and neutralize him. He doesn't necessarily have to kill him.
Do as Dr. Rourke says, Max.
Jawohl, Gruppenführer.
The captain of the trader took a step forward.
Don't!
He called to you, Dr. Rourke!
Sit down on the floor and shut up, hands on top of your head. Kronberg, do your thing.
Kronberg nodded, shoved the operator from his seat, and took control of the radio, flicking the dials to a different frequency and amplification.
This is a Condor-level code broadcast. I repeat, a Condor-level code broadcast.
After sedating the captain, the radio operator, and the original Nazi officer, Rourke and Kronberg found the first mate, and Rourke put a gun to the man's head, telling him to get everyone to report to sickbay on the double for the administration of a special inoculation, that it was discovered that the captain had cholera. In the ship's sickbay, Rourke had the pharmacist's mate administer a shot to each member of the crew from the supply of drugs Rourke had brought aboard in the two Musette bags. The men were ordered to sit down and rest in the event they should have a reaction to the shot. Within minutes, 33 crew members were passed out, or nearly so. Rourke administered a shot to the pharmacist's mate, and then, with Kronberg and Max, Rourke went about the ship finding the remaining personnel on watch. Eventually, all were sedated. Max, enjoined not to kill anyone, was sent about the ship to lock the sick bay, get the unconscious men out of the radio room and locked away into a cabin, then otherwise secure the vessel. Rourke and Kronberg returned to the radio room. Kronberg had broadcast a Reich-level security alert. There was no return message recorded while they were absent from the radio room. Rourke contacted the flying boat, getting the co-pilot on the limited-range frequency. All was well, and there was nothing inordinate coming in as they monitored enemy radio. Rourke and Kronberg waited.
What will happen when the sedation wears off?
We'll have a bunch of angry Russian seamen on our hands.
What if the Reichsfuhrer should want to talk with the captain of this vessel?
There will not be any problems with that, I think. And I speak Russian probably better than the captain does, really. So, long as I avoided any colloquialisms which might date my Russian out of the present day, I'd pass.
Perhaps we should have arranged this differently.
Yeah, perhaps, but this vessel seems an ideally neutral meeting spot, ready and waiting. We must remember that our greatest enemy is time, isn't it?
At last, a message came in over the frequency Kronberg had set. It was Grimm himself. On speaker, Rourke could hear both ends of the conversation. Kronberg told his story, that he had discovered something of the greatest importance, which could only be confided to the Reichsfuhrer personally. Grimm seemed less than enthused about the prospects of a meeting. Kronberg insisted. Finally, Grimm agreed. Three Nazi helicopter gunships, rigged with pontoons for water landings, arrived almost exactly 2 hours later. Small rubber motorized launches dropped from the gunships before they landed, and men, SS commandos, rappelling down to the launches. Heavily armed, the launches approached the Russian trading vessel, circling it as if they were in some sort of race, then taking up positions on all sides of the vessel. 10 minutes passed, with two more helicopters coming in, circling over the vessel for a period of several minutes, one of them finally landing.
He would have flown by high-speed transport from Eden City to some coastal location, then helicoptered the rest of the way.
Rourke said nothing. He watched as the helicopter which had just landed set out another of the inflatable launches, and four men in black SS commando gear, all visibly armed, exited the helicopter. A fifth man, in black BDUs as well, but wearing only a pistol at his belt, clambered down into the inflatable launch. The launch started toward the Arkhangelsk. Rourke watched the face of this fifth man, recognizing him from Allied intelligence files. It was Grimm.
Now we know whether we live or die.
Rourke set the Musette bag down beside him as he stopped at the appropriate center of the open area on the forward section of the main deck. SS commandos swarmed up both sides of the vessel, brandishing assault rifles and shouting orders.
Stay back!
Rourke merely stood, hands relaxed at his sides, waiting. In another moment, one of the commando leaders would demand cooperation and decide to back it up, and the shooting would start. Two SS commandos came up from the ladder, assault rifles at the ready. Stepping up the ladder just behind them came Grimm. Kronberg came to attention, but not being in uniform, he did not salute.
Reichsfuhrer, thank you for coming.
What is this?
Kronberg said nothing for a moment.
What is this? This man is Dr. Rourke!
Yes, Reichsfuhrer.
Arrest him!
Hear us out first, or there will be bloodshed, and you'll die too, General.
Kronberg took a step forward. Rourke noticed Kronberg's hands were shaking, but the man's voice was firm.
Reichsfuhrer, I beseech you, listen to us.
You are with Rourke? I always knew that your loyalties were not as they should be, Kronberg, but this...
Maybe his loyalties are just fine, General. Or are you so uncertain of your own loyalties that you can't risk listening to what we have to say?
Speak then, and quickly, before I lose all patience.
Let us tell you about Dr. Zimmer's Omega option.
What is this?
His plan for the death of all mankind, including you, your men here, every human being on the face of the Earth except himself, Martin Zimmer, and their surviving clones at the bunker outside Eden City. It's an airborne virus constantly mutating, attacking the body's own immune system and rendering it powerless. Within a relatively short period of time after its release, every human being on the planet will be infected and dying. You, your men, your entire army, everyone who has sworn allegiance to Dietrich Zimmer, all of his enemies too, everyone. You have a wife, a son, and two daughters. They're gonna die too. Everyone will die unless you help us to prevent it.
One of the SS commandos started toward Rourke. Rourke wheeled toward him, his coat still zipped closed a few inches above the waistband, but his hands near to the butts of the pistols.
Wait!
They stood there on the deck, under the afternoon sun, surrounded by SS commandos, Grimm, Kronberg, and John Rourke. Kronberg spoke, Rourke spoke, Grimm listened. Grimm would not, at first, believe. Rourke produced from the pocket of his bomber jacket a waterproof packet. Within it, a letter signed by Arthur Hooks, President of the United States, countersigned by the leaders or ambassadors from the other free world nations. Accompanying it was a letter signed by Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss, outlining the danger represented by the virus. This letter, countersigned by other medical authorities from around the world, the letters flown by transatmospheric insertion flights in order to be physically signed rather than bare facsimile signatures. Grimm ordered chairs brought out on deck for them and ordered his commandos back to the rail.
This is real, Helmut. Dietrich Zimmer intends to destroy the entire human race, replacing it with his own race. He wishes to make himself a god, and to build his future on the corpses of not only his enemies, but also those who have served him.
What are we to do, Otto?
Dr. Rourke has formulated a plan with several options depending on how much help you can be to us.
There are those who will follow Dietrich Zimmer even into this madness. They will have to be dealt with. I will help to prevent this. Fight to prevent this with the last breath in my body.
John Thomas Rourke was reminded of an oft-heard phrase to the effect that there was a little bad in the best of mankind and a little good in the worst. The spark of decency which had lain dormant in Reichsfuhrer Helmut Grimm, a Nazi, despicable by any moral standard, had been discovered and ignited into flame. The officers from among the SS unit, all but one of them, accompanying Grimm, were summoned into the radio room, Grimm personally informing them concerning the Omega Option virus. After receiving their pledges of loyalty, Grimm dispatched them to their men to deal with those who could not be trusted, placing them and the one remaining officer, fanatically loyal to Dietrich Zimmer, under arrest. Grimm contacted his own headquarters, instructing his immediate subordinates that he would be delayed in his return to Eden City because of unforeseen ramifications arising from Otto Kronberg's information. By encrypted transmission, Grimm ordered his second-in-command to stand by, keeping all officers on unofficial alert. The arrests made, 8 men and 1 officer under guard, Grimm, Kronberg, and Rourke returned to the main deck. Already, the men Grimm trusted were taking charge of the helicopters. Rourke, in contact with the crew of the flying boat, ordered the craft airborne. The Paladin was long underway toward a rendezvous with the Arkhangelsk and would arrive within the hour. Using a notepad taken from the radio room, Grimm began laying out details concerning security at Dietrich Zimmer's command bunker, force deployment, those units which could be counted upon with Eden Defense Forces, and from among the SS to remain loyal to Zimmer, those whose commanders could be counted upon to listen to reason. And gradually, John Rourke's perception of what lay ahead altered. As he had originally planned, they would find the clones, obtain the blood samples, and go forward from there in order to combat the Omega Option virus. But there would never be another chance like this to stop Dietrich Zimmer forever, taking him alive. Alive, somehow, Zimmer could be forced, through drugs or hypnosis, into revealing how the contents of the Omega Option canisters would be released into the air. Rourke desperately wanted to believe that, because he had no choice. Fully surfaced, the Paladin, seawater draining from her main deck, from the sail as well, gleaming bright in the setting sun, was incredible to behold. Vast in size beyond anything John Rourke had ever seen, the Paladin surfaced seemed larger, vastly larger, than she had ever seemed when he approached from underwater. Waiting on her main deck, accompanied by John Rourke's family, was the President of the United States. When Helmut Grimm stepped aboard the main deck, the President strode forward to meet him. They shook hands.
Is this a nightmare or a dream?
I'll let you know later.
All of our past differences, sir, are behind us. We are united for the common cause of humanity.
It is agreed, President, for the common cause of humanity.
There is much to do, sir.
And little time.
The President of the United States looked at John Rourke.
I believe that you are in charge from here, Doctor.
Commander Washington would lead the Transglobal Alliance Commando Force. Lieutenant General Thomas Wilson, Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, would lead the main body of the U.S. Ground Forces. Wolfgang Mann would, for the moment, rejoin the armed forces of New Germany, resuming his rank of Generaloberst. Naval forces of the United States Atlantic Fleet were standing by to move into position off what, before the night of the war, had been the Georgia coast and was now the heart of Eden. A small contingent of commandos from Australia and Defense Force personnel from Lidvelded Island would be assigned to Lieutenant General Thomas Wilson's Marines. There would also be a small contingent of personnel from the Russian Defense Forces. Airborne troops from the Chinese Second City, the current-day Republic of China, would jump with Marine airborne personnel. No invasion force such as this had ever been so hastily assembled. At the moment that the general assault began, Grimm and Kroenberg would go on television and radio, quickly outlining the nature of Dietrich Zimmer's Omega option, the threat posed by the virus, and ordering all Nazi divisions to stand down, except for those under the personal command of Kroenberg and Grimm, which could be counted upon to seize Nazi strongholds throughout North and South America. Via various means of communication, certain key commanders trusted by both Grimm and Kroenberg were being enlisted to seize control of certain strategic sites and to arrest certain commanders loyal to Dietrich Zimmer, all just prior to the actual invasion. Word from the Dauntless, where Thorn Rolvag worked around the clock supervising the placement of the nuclear charges along the course of the suboceanic rift, was that all would be in readiness within 48 hours. The schedule was being accelerated because the speed at which the rift was moving toward the North American plate was increasing with every hour. In 7 days, the rift would meet the plate if it had not been stopped. The results, according to the latest testing, were no longer even slightly in dispute. If the rift struck the North American plate, the ring of fire surrounding the Pacific Basin would erupt in a chain reaction, forming a caldera, destroying the Earth. As to the results of the explosions, which would be used to divert the rift, rob it of energy, even the best computer scenarios were not in agreement. There would be eruptions, there would be tidal waves, there would be disaster. Coastal populations everywhere, especially in the Hawaiian Islands, were being evacuated inland. Earthquakes in Hawaii and elsewhere were increasing in magnitude and frequency. In light of this, a few hours were set aside aboard the Paladin for a wedding ceremony. Emma lent Natalia her dress. The Paladin surfaced once again, the ceremony taking place on her main deck. Everyone from the Paladin's complement who was not on duty attended. John Rourke, flanked by Emma and Sarah, stood watching as the Paladin's chaplain performed the ceremony. When at last the chaplain declared,
"I now pronounce you man and wife!"
Michael took Natalia into his arms, turning back her veil, and kissed her. John Rourke put his arm around Sarah's shoulders while Emma held his hand. The V-Stall bombers would fly from the surface flight deck. The moon was still up, seen fitfully only because of heavy cloud cover. Volcanic ash, some of it, Rourke knew. He climbed up onto the wing stem, stashing his gear aft of the second seat. Emma climbed up after him, settling herself in the pilot's seat. His gear stowed, rifle, other equipment, he looked across the flight deck. Annie and Paul, Michael and Natalia, all of them moving to their assigned aircraft. Wolfgang Mann and Sarah left immediately after the wedding of Michael and Natalia. Commander Washington and his men were already at the staging area. John Rourke looked skyward, wishing that he could see the stars, but they were obscured. As a boy, he had always wondered what lay out there, waiting to be discovered or to discover. As a young man, he had often wondered if, by some chance, someone were looking down from those stars. Could the folly of mankind be seen? As a husband and father, as a man forced to fight for his family's survival, John Rourke had longed for the stars. They were the physical embodiment of his hope, that there was something more than destruction and death in the universe. But still well before dawn, the stars were hidden from him. They would terrain follow in order to avoid enemy sensing devices such as radar, so they would not fly above the clouds and the stars would remain obscured. After all these years, when he needed them most, they were not there. John Rourke closed his eyes for a moment.
The fault lies not in our stars.
Rourke opened his eyes again and started settling himself into the co-pilot's seat. Dietrich Zimmer sipped his breakfast coffee. Within the heart of the bunker, night and day were discernible only by the changing of the digits on a clock. Martin entered the room.
Sit down, my son.
What is it, Father?
I wanted to inform you of my plans for us.
What plans, Father?
You have heard me mention that if my attempts to control your natural father should fail, that I had a contingency plan which would assure our success. Do you recall?
Yes, Father.
Good. I shall tell you what it is. We shall be alone for a very long time, you and I. A good time for us to become better friends. For you to learn to grow in wisdom.
Alone? Are we going someplace again?
No, we'll remain here, at least for a while. For just the two of us, there is enough to sustain us for a very long time here.
Just the two of us?
Yes, Martin. I have decided that once our enemies have activated their explosives in the hope of deterring the volcanic rift, whether or not they succeed, I shall initiate a project of my own. Should the efforts of our own enemies fail in preventing the explosions of the Ring of Fire, and their planet itself dies, we shall still have struck the final blow. Should their efforts prevail, you and I will rule the Earth together! We will not be alone, always. Within 10 years, we can begin the repopulation process. We shall live through many of these bodies. We have clones waiting to take our memories, through which we will live forever! In a lifetime or two, Martin, a race of men will walk the Earth like no men ever before. And we will be their sovereign lords, you and I.
What do you mean?
Mankind is inferior, but the seeds of greatness are in my hands. We control the future. And if the world should end, then we will die knowing that there is a god, and he engineered this destruction of the Earth in order to prevent me from becoming his equal. What is God, after all, but an all-powerful immortal? If the planet lives, all of mankind save ourselves and our clones and the raw genetic material I have preserved shall die. And I will be the architect of the new Genesis. I will create life! It will flow from my hands. Is that not being a god, Martin?
I guess.
The concept is overwhelming, I know. But you will be a god as well. And the race of men we put upon the face of the planet will serve us.
Yes, Father.
On the ice field, there was perfect whiteness, and the sky above, relatively cloudless, was a deep, piercing blue. The skins of the aircraft gleamed dully. The weapons in the hands of the men and women of the Allied Commando Force smelled of lubricant as they passed. The cold made the skin tingle. He held Emma's hand as they walked across the glacier. This was life. Soon it might all end forever. Inside the command tent, Commander Washington was giving his briefing.
As I was saying, ladies and gentlemen, ours is the first prong of the attack. Until we have gained entrance to the bunker and reached the clones and secured the blood samples so that the serum can be made, no other action will be taken. Once the signal is given that the blood samples are secure, everything happens fast. There will be amphibious landings on the coast. Marine and Chinese airborne elements will attack Eden City. Fighter aircraft will strike Eden's air defenses, and the Nazi armies should be up for grabs. As it looks now, certain Nazi units under the personal command of officers trusted by Reichsfuhrer Grimm and Gruppenfuhrer Kroenberg can be counted on, at the very least, to stand down. Others of these units will actively assist our personnel. At least that's the plan. Now, if we get enough people on the ground fast, we'll have control of Eden City and other major population centers within Eden within 24 hours or less. Other Allied units will be hitting major Nazi outposts in North and South America, and we are told we should be able to count on assistance from elements loyal to Reichsfuhrer Grimm and Gruppenfuhrer Kroenberg as well. Commander Darkwood?
We've all been given copies of the layout of the bunker as provided to us by Reichsfuhrer Grimm. The bunker is designed to withstand anything short of a direct nuclear hit. Its defense is against conventional attack quite formidable. But thanks to the help offered by Reichsfuhrer Grimm, if all goes planned, we'll be let in by the back door. That's a tunnel that is used to service a facility with such things as generator parts and other heavy equipment. The tunnel entrance is secret, but still well defended. Personnel loyal to Reichsfuhrer Grimm, and more importantly, to us, disloyal to Dietrich Zimmer in the light of his plans with the Omega Option virus, will allow us entrance and possibly assist in neutralizing forces loyal to Zimmer. Again, at least that's the plan. Once inside, we'll break up into two elements. Commander Washington will lead the bulk of the force against the main portion of the command bunker. Dr. Rourke, the smaller of these two elements, against the genetics laboratory and actual command center, where Zimmer himself should be found. We need to control the command bunker entirely. Dietrich Zimmer has some means by which he can control the release of the Omega Option virus. We can't let any equipment get touched by Zimmer or his son Martin, nor can we let any equipment be destroyed. We have to seize control as rapidly as possible, with as little damage to the real estate as possible. Otherwise, if we fail, we could well give Zimmer the win, allowing the release of the Omega Option virus before Allied scientists can distill a serum from the blood samples we'll be taking, and before they can begin to disseminate the serum.
Excuse me a moment.
Certainly, sir.
All faces turned toward his. Rourke recognized many of them. Navy SEALs, German long-range mountain patrol commandos, his wife's father and brother, his son and daughter, Natalia and Paul.
There's only one point I want to make. This sounds like a speech before a football game or something, I know. And I've never been any good at that kind of thing. But in the final analysis, although we'll fight to the last breath to win, what really matters is how we play the game. Why we fight. If we go down together in death, we'll at least know that we tried, that we did our best, that we gave it our all. And even if we're all gone, all of humanity, that'll still count. I can't tell you how, but I know it'll count. That's all I got to say, except maybe God bless you all.
No faces looked away. No one spoke. John Rourke said nothing more. At twilight, the aircraft were underway. Not V-stalls. The Trans-Global Alliance had developed a small fleet of top-secret bombers designed to be sensor-invisible because of special materials, construction, paint, and sound-dampening equipment. They had never been tactically employed until John Rourke, his family, and the Allied commandos boarded the aircraft on the glacier. In full jump gear, the men and women of the commando force sat huddled together on long benches along either side of the fuselage. Some listened to music through headphones. Some read. Some few slept. One or two wrote letters they would leave behind aboard the aircraft to be delivered in the event that they did not return. Some sharpened their knives. Some made last-minute checks of their firearms. All, except those who slept, periodically consulted their watches. 23 hours remained before the nuclear warheads along the volcanic rift would be detonated. The same amount of time which remained before they would be inside the tunnel. The tunnel leading them to their fate with Dietrich Zimmer. John Rourke did not sleep. He thought of Emma. She piloted a V-Stahl fighter bomber that would not be airborne until just prior to the attack. She would lead the first wave aerial assault against the bunker. He thought of Sarah. She would assist at Allied headquarters for the invasion, liaising between the forces of New Germany, in part commanded by her husband-to-be, and the United States Marine Corps ground forces. He thought of Annie. She would be stationed outside the bunker with a small force of Allied commandos, poised to utilize that singular power which she alone possessed, her ability to tell if any of the members of the Rourke family with whom she had her empathic bond were in mortal danger. If she sensed that the attack within the bunker was going badly, she alone had the authority to order in additional personnel. Hers was a tremendous and frightening responsibility. He thought of Natalia. She would be part of the attack on the bunker, her skills indispensable beside him, as they always had been. He thought of Michael. His son would be with Commander Washington, co-leading the main assault force within the bunker, charged with the Herculean task of subduing all resistance without allowing destruction of computers, electronic equipment, or records. He thought of Paul. Paul would be with him, as always, and had as his primary responsibility the task of getting the blood samples, taken from the clones, into Allied hands as rapidly as possible. He thought of himself. It was his job to lead the smaller element of the attack force on the bunker, ensuring that the blood samples could be taken from the clones and capturing or otherwise neutralizing Zimmer, and probably Martin as well. He had never intended to have the fate of mankind rest upon his abilities, abilities everyone around him seemed to regard much more highly than he ever did. John Rourke had never intended any of this. He had studied the art of staying alive, viewed as very real the chance that mankind might well endeavor to destroy itself in the folly of warfare. All he had ever wanted was to protect his family. 625 years after the night of the war, he would likely meet death at last. The jump was high altitude, high opening, their path through the night sky guided by passive reception of satellite signals. Again, he could not see the stars, but man-made stars guided him and the others from the commando force. All personnel, with the exception of Tim Shaw and his son Ed, were experienced, and the landing was without serious incident, one parachutist getting caught up in a stand of pines, but already having cut himself free before help arrived. One of the jump canisters containing food supplies was partially damaged when it landed on an outcropping of granite, but the contents were unharmed. The commando force landed in four elements, regrouping at a predetermined set of coordinates and moving immediately to the intermediate objective. This was a heavily wooded, snow-covered area in rolling hills about 10 miles outside of Eden City itself, only 7 miles from the location of the bunker. With 15 hours to go before H-hour, human and electronic sentries posted along their encampment's perimeter. Each man and woman, some alone, some in groups, took a quick, hearty meal, then slept. John Rourke busied himself for a time with checking sentry positions, as did Commander Washington, Paul, Michael, Natalia, and James Darkwood. Before retiring, Rourke conferred with the other leaders of the commando force, reviewing their immediate plans for the morning. After everyone was up, the commando group would move in four separate elements, linking up again approximately 1 mile from the tunnel service entrance to the bunker, then following an infiltration schedule which would get them on site at the appointed time at the primary objective. Rourke left the informal meeting, rolled out his sleeping bag beside Paul's and James Darkwood's, and closed his eyes. He did not consciously dream, which he had always considered a benefit derived from his time spent in cryogenic sleep. He awoke once during the night, sat listening to the night for a while, then returned to sleep. Snow fell overnight, the snow gray-tinged with volcanic ash. Zipping out of the mummy-style bag he'd elected to use, Rourke pulled on his jacket and his boots. He shaved, washed as well as he could, and began gathering his gear. Within another 20 minutes, the rest of the camp was up or getting there. Cold rations were a thing of the past. Modern field rations were packaged in containers which chemically heated the contents without the need of a fire or boiling water. Rourke breakfasted more heavily than usual in light of the long hike ahead of him. By a half hour after dawn, the camp, with the exception of the disturbed snow, was in order. The slit trenches covered, everything which had been expended policed and buried. At the head of his own element, Rourke took a last geosynchronous satellite bearing, which he confirmed with his old-fashioned lensatic compass, and started his people down through the woods toward the rendezvous. With 2 hours remaining before H-hour, infiltration toward the service tunnel entrance was already underway. In teams of three persons each, Rourke, Paul, and James Darkwood formed their own team, like the others moving through the woods, along the lengths of defiles, avoiding any terrain against which they might be silhouetted. As night at last came, the sky was heavily overcast. The snow, which had fallen lightly overnight, returned in full measure, heavy flakes building rapidly into deep accumulation. They paused briefly to don snow smocks in order to blend in with the altered terrain. But the temperature was still mild enough and the snow was not driven on strong winds. The snow, in fact, although it made finding one's footing at times more difficult, almost warmed them as they moved. 20 minutes before H-hour, Rourke, Paul, and James Darkwood paused once again, consuming a hurried meal, taking care of biological necessities, making their last weapons checks. In addition to his customary German MP-40 submachine gun, Paul carried a modern cartridge-firing assault rifle, identical to the one carried by Darkwood. In addition to his handguns, John Rourke had the HK-91 rifle. After finishing their meal, they set out into the last phase of their infiltration route, Rourke closely monitoring their position by satellite and by compass. 7 minutes before H-hour, they were at the rendezvous, other infiltration teams already in place, a few more still to come. Few words were exchanged. The digital mission clock built into his satellite positioning receiver reached the hour. In the Pacific, at this very instant, Thorn Rolvag would be detonating the first of the suboceanic charges. Silently, Rourke and the other element leaders signaled the commandos to move out. The tunnel mouth was heavily guarded, a dozen men in SS Commando uniforms posted strategically overlooking the driveway off the road toward the service tunnel entrance. More personnel on the driveway itself, at the first and second service gates, and on watch beside the deflection barriers. The mouth of the tunnel itself was overset with a canopy of synth concrete, providing protection from the air as well. John Rourke glanced at his watch, the mission clock too cumbersome to bother with now. As the second hand of his black-faced Rolex swept over the inverted triangle in the 12 position, two van-like trucks emerged from the tunnel entrance, pulling all the way forward to the interior gate. Two more trucks followed into the driveway about 30 seconds behind the first two, these latter moving one to each side of the drive. Men exited the trucks. This was the changing of the guard shift, and if Helmut Anton Grimm had carried off what he said he could, these new guards would be the key to Allied penetration of the bunker. Rourke watched, waited, squinted through the falling snow. The routine was that the watch detail, which was replaced, would board the trucks and return to the interior of the bunker. But that routine would not be carried out in full this time, if all went well. The guard changed, the men who had been on duty began entering their trucks. The trucks closed up and started back inside the bunker. Once the trucks had disappeared, John Rourke watched for the signal. A flashlight was turned on, then off, three times in rapid succession. Flanked by Natalia and Paul, Rourke started up from his position in the snow. Natalia touched his arm.
This could all be an elaborate trap, John.
What choice do we have, Natalia?
Natalia smiled, the surreal blueness of her eyes always had and always would touch him into his soul. She got up, Paul as well. The rest of their unit, six men, SEALs and German long-range mounted commandos, were moving as well. The remainder of the first wave of the commando force kept in hiding. Rourke looked at his watch again. By now, the auxiliary commando unit to which Annie was assigned was into position outside the main entrance to the bunker, waiting. Emma's squadron would be airborne, moving into position for the first wave of the aerial bombardment of the bunker. Washington and the rest of the commando unit here at the bunker's service entrance would be ready either to move into the bunker or to take cover should this be some sort of trap and a firefight were about to ensue. Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, Natalia Tyamarovna, and the six commandos came down along a narrow defile and into the open, a few yards off from the road leading toward the gates. Rourke mentally shrugged, then strode forward onto the road. Any normal patrolling formation would have been absurd under the circumstances, all nine of them in full open view of the guard positions and heavily outnumbered. Rourke, his rifle slung at his side, his right hand on the pistol grip, kept his eyes on the first gate. It was opening.
So far, so good.
The officer in charge of the guard detail, bearing the SS rank equivalent of a first lieutenant, introduced himself as Obersturmfuhrer Danzig, saluting as he did so. John Rourke returned the salute.
What happened to the men from the original guard detail, Lieutenant?
Harmlessly gassed, General. We will utilize those same trucks as a means of getting your personnel through the tunnel to the main portion of the bunker. If you will accompany me, General.
Let's drive with the windows open, though, huh?
Rourke signaled with his flashlight toward the positions occupied by Washington, Michael, Darkwood, and the others. Allied commandos dropped out of trees, slid out from behind rocks, and began filling the roadway, their weapons at the ready, starkly black against the white of their snow smocks. The group walked through the second gate.
May I ask, General, if the detonations beneath the Pacific Ocean have begun yet?
I believe that they have, Lieutenant, if they began on schedule.
If I may say so, General, let us hope that your scientists are successful.
And that we are successful here tonight as well.
They were walking beneath the synth concrete lip which lay over the mouth of the tunnel, when the ground began shaking beneath their feet. Rourke stopped. Danzig and the three enlisted personnel with him froze.
It is starting!
Paul's face looked ashen beneath the arc lights. The tremor passed as quickly as it had come. As they started forward again, the ground shook more violently than it had a second ago. Rourke looked up. The lip of the synth concrete over them began to separate itself from the tunnel mouth.
God in heaven! It is the end of the world!
Get us inside! Now! Move!
The concrete overhang was collapsing around them.
Yes, General! Of course we must!
Rourke activated the jaw profile radio at the side of his mouth.
This is Rourke! Get back! All bets are off! We're going in, getting what we came for! Meet us out front!
The shaking of the ground was unlike anything John Rourke had ever experienced, could ever have imagined. With each step, it was necessary to fight to keep his balance. And now, as he neared the tunnel mouth, the roadway surface beneath his combat-booted feet was cracking, splitting into massive chunks, debris exploding upward, pieces of the tunnel casing flying everywhere around him. A piece of synth concrete struck at his left arm, tearing the snow smock. Rourke kept running. The tunnel mouth was just ahead of him. Natalia and Paul, Danzig and his three men near one of the trucks. There were other SS-uniformed personnel around them, but all of them, apparently with Danzig, loyal to Helmut Anton Grimm and disloyal to Dietrich Zimmer.
Zimmer will release the virus if he thinks this is the end! Into the trucks!
Paul swung up into the passenger seat of one of the trucks, Natalia in through the open side door. The trucks were already starting into motion. Rourke quickened his pace, slabs of synth concrete from the tunnel ceiling starting to separate, synth concrete dust everywhere, and the ground still shook even more violently than before. The roadbed sheared in half. As Rourke looked up, one of the trucks had overturned. John Rourke ran, jumping over a slab of synth concrete, reaching the truck and throwing himself inside. Natalia, Lieutenant Danzig, Danzig's three men, and two other men were inside. Rourke looked forward. The truck was accelerating, another of the SS men at the wheel. The truck swerved, nearly impacting the tunnel wall, a massive slab of synth concrete catapulting outward from the opposite side of the tunnel.
Keep driving! Faster!
Rourke balanced himself as the truck swerved, his arms outstretched toward the bulkheads as he pitched himself into one of the seats.
This is the end!
One of Danzig's men made the sign of the cross. Rourke wondered where an SS man had learned that, but was glad that the fellow had.
If it isn't, we have to get the blood so we can...
Rourke looked through the rear window of the truck. The tunnel was collapsing behind them, the road surface buckling upward in massive slabs, the walls imploding.
Drive faster, man! Have your man get us to the biolab section now! We have to get to Zimmer and we have to get to the clones! Before it's too late! Now! Now!
And deep inside his soul, John Rourke wondered if perhaps it was already too late. Danzig slipped from his seat, crawled forward along the length of the truck, shouting to the man behind the wheel.
Take us to Section 11. Go by way of the south tunnel. As rapidly as you can, Rottenführer. Quickly, quickly!
Natalia held Rourke's arm.
We must get out of here, Father!
When the world is being destroyed, Martin, where else is there to go? Sink! But we will still defy our fate! Come with me!
And Dietrich Zimmer grabbed his son's shoulders, hauling Martin up from his knees. Rubble rained down around them, the ceiling of the bunker collapsing, pieces of tile flying from it like missiles.
I don't want to die!
We can die as cowards, or we can die defiant! Come with me!
Zimmer dragged Martin in his wake, out of the inner office, into the corridor leading toward the biological sciences laboratory. His clones, his secret of immortality, lay within, and so also did his means to defy his fate. The truck lurched. Natalia grabbed for one of the seat backs, flew forward, and crashed against the front passenger seat. Rourke's head slammed against the headliner as he rolled his body, stopping, wedged between one of the seat backs and the roof.
Paul.
Rourke looked forward. His friend was hanging upside down from his seat, shaking his head. The driver of the van lay half through the windshield, from the attitude of his neck and back, quite obviously dead. Danzig held his left arm.
Ah, it is broken, General. But we can go on.
You're a brave man, Lieutenant. Help Major Tim Narona.
Rourke started forward to free Paul from the seat restraint. Paul's left shoulder had dislocated.
Yep. Bite on your glove. Let me have your arm.
Rourke rotated the arm.
Can you make it?
Oh, what choice do I have?
Danzig and his three men leading the way, Rourke, Natalia, and Paul Rubinstein followed, running along what remained of the tunnel. Debris still fell on them, but the shaking had stopped.
Do you think it's over, John?
Honest answer, no! Hurry!
At the very least, there would be aftershocks, and the fabric of the tunnel itself wouldn't withstand much more. Once they reached the biolabs area, assuming they could, and assuming, too, that the lab had not collapsed, even if they were able to obtain blood samples from the clones of Zimmer and Martin, it was more than likely that the main entrance to the bunker might be sealed, that they would be trapped inside, buried alive. Rourke kept running. Dietrich Zimmer clambered over a mound of collapsed ceiling material, Martin still in tow.
We can get out of here, Father!
To where, boy? To where? The Earth is being destroyed. God destroying the Earth in order to cheat me of my power! There is nowhere to run to, Martin. But he will not cheat me now.
We don't know that the world is ending, Father. We can't just stay here. We can't!
The plan of Rolvag and the other allied scientists did not work, Martin. Instead of halting the progress of the suboceanic rift, they have torn the fabric of the planet with their warheads. The Earth is dying, and we will die.
But not before you and I release the Omega Option virus! Hurry, boy!
Why, Father? Everyone is dying, you say? Why bother with the virus now?
Why? Why? Because I have the power to do so! Come with me! Die with me!
Only up ahead, General!
The tunnel took a sharp bend. When they came around the bend, John Rourke stopped, leaning against the tunnel wall for an instant, then just stood there, staring ahead. Danzig and his three men were stopped as well, Danzig swaying, about to collapse. John Rourke looked past Danzig and his three men. There was a security entrance, no one guarding it, and the door was falling away from its frame. Rourke walked ahead slowly. The ground was starting to shake again, but he was incapable of running again for at least a few seconds. There was light from beyond the doorway. The electricity within the structure somehow still operational, although many of the overhead light fixtures were down or destroyed. There were piles of rubble, overturned desks and chairs, computer monitors still on, but lying on their side. Rourke looked behind him. Natalia and Paul were coming, Paul's right hand holding his battered old Browning high power, but pressed tightly to his left shoulder. The mild movement of the ground beneath them was becoming more violent. Rourke quickened his pace as much as he could. Pieces of the tunnel ceiling were beginning to fall free again. He edged closer to the tunnel wall. At last, beside the doorway, John Rourke swung the muzzle of his rifle ahead of him, then began to clamber over the rubble. Dietrich Zimmer righted the chair and sat down. Martin stood beside him. The trembling of the earth, which had begun again only seconds ago, had once again subsided. The computer console before Dietrich Zimmer still functioned.
After you do this, Father, can we try to leave?
Again, son, where would we go?
Martin considered that, and the answer was beyond his reasoning. His two fathers, his natural father, John Rourke, was convinced that evil would perish and right would triumph. His adoptive father, Dietrich Zimmer, believed that there was no good, no evil, only the force of will. Tonight, both goodness and will would die. Only evil, which was death, would triumph.
What are you doing?
I am programming the simultaneous release by radio signal of every single canister of the Omega Option virus. Should any human being survive this night, he will not survive the virus.
And what will become of us?
You can leave here, Martin. And if the Earth survives, you can survive with it.
Martin Rourke Zimmer turned around to stare toward the origin of the voice. He saw his birth father, John Thomas Rourke.
Stop him while I activate the virus!
John Rourke stabbed the rifle that was in his right hand toward them.
I want to kill you so very much, Zimmer, but don't make me.
Martin Zimmer's eyes shifted from John Rourke to Dietrich Zimmer.
In the end, John Rourke, you and all that you have ever stood for have lost. The world is ending. I am merely having my moment. You won't have your moment.
Dietrich Zimmer started to touch the keyboard. Martin Zimmer wheeled toward John Rourke.
Come with me and have a chance, son!
Martin Zimmer decided. He turned toward the computer console. The monitor read, press 00 to initiate program. Martin reached toward the keyboard, striking the letter 0 once, about to strike it again.
No!
Paul Rubinstein looked away from Martin Zimmer and down at the battered old Browning high power in his right hand.
God forgive me.
Natalia was standing beside him.
We have the blood samples, John.
Paul Rubinstein opened his eyes and looked at his best friend, whose son he had just shot to death. John Rourke's eyes streamed tears, but his head was held erect.
Thank you, Paul, for saving me from doing it. Thank you.
And then John started toward the computer console. The CD-ROM discs from Zimmer's computer console were secured in the musette bag at John Rourke's side. Together with Paul and Natalia, who carried the blood samples from the clones, she had turned off their life support system, she told him, and Lieutenant Danzig and Danzig's three men, they ran along the corridor from the biolabs.
The only way out would be Dr. Zimmer's private escape shaft, if it has not already collapsed. We are more than 100 meters below the surface here. The escape shaft led straight up to the surface level of the bunker, and a vault door near it.
John Rourke ran alongside Danzig.
Here it is!
Danzig turned into a partially collapsed doorway. Beyond it, elaborate double doors sprung from their hinges. Beyond these doors was an office, austere by comparison to Zimmer's facility in Western Canada. No black marble, no gold swastika. Rourke looked back, seeing nothing except more of the bunker collapsing around them. On the far wall of the office was a tapestry. Danzig, trying to rip it away, Paul helping him. Behind the tapestry lay a steel door with an electronic combination lock. Danzig dropped to one knee before it.
Try the handle!
Paul twisted at the handle. The door did not open.
Can we detonate the door, eh?
Natalia shoved past them, handing the blood samples to one of Danzig's men.
Lose these or break them, and you won't have to worry about being buried alive here.
Reaching into the black bag at her side and dropping to her knees before the doorway, Natalia set a small charge against the mating point of the door to the frame where the vertical locking bolt should be.
Back off and take cover!
The door is open, General!
Up the ladder as fast as you can!
Danzig's men were starting through. Rourke and Natalia were beside the vault door.
Thank you for making me what I am, John Rourke.
Paul passed through the doorway, John Rourke after him. As John Rourke took to the first rung of the ladder, a gush of water blew into the small tunnel. The plumbing system must have failed completely in the rumbling. If they did not move quickly, they would surely drown. Rourke looked down. The water was filling the escape shaft, rising faster than they were climbing.
Keep going!
The water roared beneath them now, pushing so violently and so rapidly upward that the air around them was like wind. Rourke looked up, seeing Danzig disappear through the opening above. Then Danzig's man with the blood samples, and then the other two men. Then Natalia. Paul was nearly out of the shaft. The water was gushing upward around them. The water engulfed them as Paul lurched upward, Rourke's hands grasping for the top rung as the water slammed him against the wall of the shaft. He closed his fist over something solid and cold. It was the handle at the top of the ladder. The water hammered his body against the roof of the shaft. There was a door. The door was closed. John Rourke was engulfed, his body hurtling forward into the darkness.
Amen.
Rourke's right hand reached for the knife, fisting it firmly as his eyes swept the room.
All right. Who wants a drumstick?
Rourke caught the eye of the youngest person in the room, Michael and Natalia's littlest one, Sarah Ann. She was 9 and very much the perfect sophisticate, with hair black as a raven's wing and eyes a brilliant blue, just like her mother's. She cocked an eyebrow toward him as if to say, "Adults are really dumb sometimes, Uncle Paul." He merely shrugged his shoulders, agreeing but enjoying himself nonetheless. Paul Rubinstein would make an entry about today in his journal, as he did about this day every year. Someday, each child in this room would be given a copy of the journal and know what had gone before and why they were here. To have done otherwise would have been unthinkable. This was the Rourke family's personal holiday, the 19th of October. Although the family got together for every major holiday, which was sometimes challenging, having a day which was all their own was a necessity. The 19th of October was selected for what Paul Rubinstein had always considered a wonderfully logical reason. It was the birthday of Natalia's uncle, General Ishmael Varakov. Without Varakov's perfect humanity, none of them would have survived the great conflagration. And the general, who had kept his office without walls in a museum in a city which no longer existed, deserved to be remembered and revered. Paul continued looking about the room as John wielded the knife in heroic battle against the turkey. Emma and John's daughter, Paula, almost 16 and as beautiful as her mother, was dashing in from the kitchen with a steaming hot dish of something or other in her hands. Timothy, John and Emma's son, was 14 now, and as tall and well-built as a full-grown man. And like all the rest of the men in the family, just sitting there, waiting for dinner to begin. Beside Timothy sat Paul and Annie's youngest, John Michael. Jack was a month younger than Timothy, and although more slightly built, matched him in height. Paul turned his head and looked his daughter, Natalie, straight in the eye and smiled. Then he looked past Natalie into his wife's eyes. Although Natalie was 16 and Annie was in her early 40s, the two of them looked enough alike to be twins, or at least he thought so. And his opinion counted better than anyone's when it came to that. Michael and Natalia's son, John Paul, sat opposite Annie. He was 12 years old, a fine, handsome young man, tall and straight, but soft-spoken and a little shy. Of all the children, he bore the greatest resemblance to John, his grandfather, the resemblance both physical and otherwise. A natural athlete, he seemed to spend all other waking moments reading or working at a computer terminal. His nephew, John Paul, would be interesting to watch growing into manhood, Paul thought. John Thomas Rourke sat on the porch steps, a thin, dark tobacco cigar clamped in his teeth, his eyes on the stars in the night sky. From the pocket of his faded blue jeans, he took his battered old Zippo wind lighter, rolling the striking wheel under his thumb, thrusting the tip of the cigar into the lighter's blue-yellow flame. Before flicking closed the cowling, he held the lighter near the black-faced Rolex on his left wrist. It was nearly 9:30 in the evening. Tomorrow, he and Emma would fly to New Germany. Wolfgang and Sarah, New Germany's president and first lady, along with their two daughters, would meet them at the airport. There was a new medical school opening in New Germany, with all the finest in equipment and research facilities, and the best staff to be had. Officially being dedicated on the day after tomorrow, try as he had, John Rourke was unable to convince the directors of the university that the new medical school should be named after someone besides himself. He had suggested Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Krauss as the logical person to be honored. Once he, Paul, Natalia, and Helmut Grimm's men had gotten out of Dietrich Zimmer's bunker with the blood samples, it was she who spearheaded the effort to produce the serum which would defeat the Omega Option virus. Indeed, whether or not all the canisters of Zimmer's Omega Option virus would ever be found and disposed of didn't really matter because of her. The serum worked and was now part of the standard immunization battery for every human being on the face of the Earth. An interesting side effect, however, was that since the dissemination of the vaccine against the Omega Option, there had been no outbreaks of influenza on the globe, and the common cold was virtually unknown. Were Dietrich Zimmer alive, it would have been the ultimate ignominy for him to realize that as a result of his efforts to destroy mankind, lives were actually being saved. The good part about the trip to New Germany, of course, was that aside from seeing Sarah, Wolf, and their daughters, he would get to see his old friend Thorn Rolvag. Rolvag lectured in New Germany 3 months out of every year. Thorn had gambled with the very life of the planet and won. The explosives planted along the suboceanic rift had indeed vented the volcanic energy, which would otherwise have destroyed the planet. For a time, certain of Rolvag's less scrupulous colleagues had attempted to blame Rolvag for the earthquakes and tidal waves which ensued in the immediate aftermath of the suboceanic explosions, saying that his calculations were in error. But time and unbiased research cleared Rolvag's name, despite his few vocal detractors. And today, Rolvag was accorded the credit he deserved, revered as the world's leading authority on volcanology. Emma came out onto the porch. Rourke looked at her, smiling. Sweeping her skirt under her, she sat down beside him.
Pondering the imponderable? Or just thinking about Michael?
Actually, I wasn't thinking about Michael. If he wants to run for the presidency, good for him. Politics have never interested me.
But I'll bet you that the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November next year, you'll be the first man in Hawaii inside a voting booth.
If he runs, oh yeah, I'll vote for him.
So what were you thinking about then?
A lot of things.
Not in a talkative mood, are you, John Rourke?
John Rourke heeled out his cigar and put his arm around Emma's shoulders.
Why don't we forget we've got a house full of family and just look up at the stars for a while?
And they did.
Survivalist Death Watch is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1994, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Directed and adapted by Johann Detweiler. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth and James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net,
where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other titles in graphic audio.
There's two banks in Dodge City. Both are full of cattlemen's money, according to what I've heard. We hit them both, hard and fast, right after they open. Make examples out of them that tries to fight back. Gun them down like ducks coming off a pond.
I hear Dodge can be a tough town, Bill. Maybe you hadn't ought to figure that'll be that easy.
You done turned yellow dog on us, Curly. I got no use for a damn coward.
You ain't gonna shoot me, Bill.
You ain't left me no choice, Kirk. I gotta make an example out of you.
We've been together since...
Any more you sons of bitches got anything to say?
My name's Wyatt Earp. I'm the city marshal. Just curious as to why you're carrying so many guns at this hour.
Smoke Jensen. I was headed down to check on a herd I brought in yesterday. As to the guns, I rarely go anywhere without them. Old habit, I reckon.
It's called fate. Some men have got the fates dead set against them. Smoke is one. Most other men can ride all the way from California to Dodge City without having so much as a loose horseshoe. Smoke don't hardly ever get that kind of peace. It's the hand of fate that keeps guiding them toward the fight.
Welcome to Dodge, Mr. Bloody Bill Anderson. We've got a little surprise waiting for you.
Saddle up and ride into adventure with Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man 22. Pride of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.